Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. Match day 32 in the books. It was an absolute banger. Lionel Messi is back and not off the bench like a couple bozos on this podcast suggested. 90 minutes from the GOAT. Two goals, one assist, another assist called back for offside. Messi's back. Miami are still rolling. They're chasing the points record and potentially much, much more. We will talk about Inter Miami. We'll talk Hell is Real. We'll talk El Tráfico, which was an absolute advertisement for that rivalry, the two teams in LA, and everything we love about Major League Soccer. And we'll talk Mikey Varis to San Diego FC, staying in Southern California. Doyle, what's up, man? How you doing? I almost called it Southern Florida. What am I doing?
Yeah, that's a different part of the country. You know, your head, you said El Tráfico. In my head, I heard Hell is Real. And you said it was just an absolute advertisement for that rivalry. And I was like, what is Wiebe talking about? It took me a minute to go. What I'm saying is that my brain is scrambled. What I'm saying is that there was a lot of good soccer this weekend. Maybe Hell is Real wasn't necessarily part of it. But it felt, you know, that feeling after the September international date, you get it every year and suddenly like everybody's sprinting towards the finish. It leads to the best soccer of the season as far as I'm concerned, and that's what we got. I'm happy for it.
Dramatic soccer as well. Entering the match day on Saturday, it was basically, I think 79.9% of the season was in the books. We had 20% left, a fifth to go, and that's always the fifth if you talk to players or managers or anybody who pays attention, whether it's journalists or fans or fill in the blank. It is that last sprint that is always season-defining. It's always award-defining. It's always what really sets the stage for what's to come in the playoffs. We saw it last year with the Crew. Remember, Doyle, they were a team with defensive issues who gave up leads. And then in this part of the season, snap your fingers, it all sort of switched, and Wilfred Nancy and the boys went on to win MLS Cup. So we'll see who does that this year. We'll do the best thing we saw. All of the above, walk you through match day 32, but we do have official news in San Diego. So just want to get your quick reaction to Mikey Varis being announced as the manager of the newest club in Major League Soccer. The buzzwords tossed out in the press release were win now and player development, energy, synergy in the way that San Diego as a club sees the game and Mikey Varis sees the game. We've got a new manager. What's it mean?
I'm curious about it because we've never seen Mikey Varis in a top job at the professional level. He did really well with the US U-20s. He did less well as interim manager of the full national team in this most recent window. There's not a great track record for Greg Berhalter guys as managers in MLS now. And we saw Nico Estevez ultimately fail with FC Dallas. We saw Luchi Gonzalez ultimately fail with San Jose. Both those guys were replaced. Josh Wolf has not had a great run of it in Austin. BJ Callahan just getting started. So it's not like this coaching tree has borne a lot of fruit. But they probably have a very clear idea of how they want to play. And they see Mikey Varis as a guy who can transmit that to the players. And look, there's some positive data points because the US U-20 team played really good soccer under him. Really, really good. So the hope is that that is the version of Mikey Varis that they get, and that's what San Diego look like next year.
We'll effort to get Mikey on the show, maybe Tyler Heaps as well, the CSO there in San Diego. One good sign for Mikey and for San Diego in general, it looks like Chucky Lozano is playing the best soccer we've seen from him in a long time. I believe he is tied for the Golden Boot lead in the Eredivisie right now. So, hey, best player doing best player things. Right.
I've been watching a lot of PSV. Chucky's been great. The Eredivisie right now is dog water. Like this is not, they have not been facing murderer's row. But I do think that this was a right type of DP for this club to sign for their first big splash. I do wonder if maybe they could find a home for another guy on PSV because right now, Ricardo Pepi ain't getting any time for that team. Just keeping an eye on it.
Okay, okay. We'll just have to see how Chucky does against the likes of San Jose Earthquakes and Sporting Kansas City and Austin FC in the Western Conference next year. TBD if he'll be able to get a goal or two.
Each of those teams would hang four on Almere City. Believe me.
That's fair. That's fair. All right, we're talking about Greg Berhalter disciples, and one of them got his very first win as an MLS head coach. That would be BJ Callahan, and that gets us started with the best thing you saw, Doyle. And for whatever reason, you're choosing Nashville.
Yeah, Nashville doing stuff. That was awesome. They had an 8-game losing streak heading into this contest in Atlanta. They had been terrible in both boxes, which is the opposite of what Nashville had always been since they came to MLS anyway. It's like a team that basically did nothing through central midfield or, you know, outside of each, you know, attacking third, but were dominant in both boxes. And they had lost that this year. And, you know, BJ Callahan came in with a new game model and different ambition. And we had seen some signs of it, just it hadn't turned into goals. It hadn't turned into complete performances. And in this game, it turned into a complete performance. That first goal by Alex Muyl came off a 13-pass buildup, and then they had another later in the first half. I think it was a 26 or 28-pass buildup that led to a Sam Surridge shot that Brad Kuzan saved really well. They controlled the game with the ball. They weren't like Columbus Crew-style 60% possession, but when they got the ball, the entire team was connected by it in a way that we really haven't seen from Nashville since last year's League's Cup. And so it felt like a good, positive step forward. And Nashville fans have been pretty miserable this year. And a couple of them were in my mentions saying that this is, let's see if I can find the tweet. Tracy Edwards says, "This was the most fun I've had watching Nashville play since our last NPSL team that got everyone but the center backs forward. It warmed my heart." So you could see that Nashville fans were dying for something to be happy about, and they got it in this game. And Weeby, they're still alive for the 9 seed in that Eastern Conference sort of stumble down the stretch.
Yeah, I was likening it to a demolition derby this weekend on Countdown and Wrap Up, because, you know, these aren't Ferraris, these aren't Lamborghinis, these aren't Formula One cars. They are, in many cases, beaten to a pulp, broken windshield.
Are they Audis? They're not Audis.
No, that's a fine, that is a quality driving machine, Doyle.
I would call it the best of all cars.
Probably. I don't have the good fortune to own one, but maybe in the future, if I do, I'll be able to have firsthand knowledge on that. But look, Nashville are alive. I don't think they're going to do it. This is it's a light in a very dark period for the club. But if you drill down a little bit more, it's not just that Nashville were pretty good. I'm not going to go too far on this one. They still are just hovering at like one expected goal. It's not like they racked up shots on target. I will say that that Teal Bunbury interplay with Hani Mukhtar and then the finish for the second goal had me remembering the best of the Hani moments, and also remembering why Teal still sees the field, is that he just finds a way to have chemistry with your best player over and over and over. But Atlanta were so bad, Doyle, and we'll get to that in a little bit, that I still remain a skeptic for Nashville. I still think it's 2025 that they're planned for. Meanwhile, for the Galaxy, 2024, baby, we're back. The Golden Era is back. The Shrine is it's on fire. Like, we have a bonfire in the corner of my basement right now. The Galaxy are top of the West. They're up 7 points on LAFC, and we'll do the big breakdown in a second. Ricky Pouge was magnificent. All these great moments, none better, in my opinion, than Edwin freaking Cerrillo, who had not scored a single MLS goal in his life entering this game. And he dropped a bang a langer. I mean, this is like anybody in the world is proud of this. The technique, the way he struck it into the top corner. Hugo Lloris, no chance. World Cups, yes. Saving Edwin Cerrillo, no. I mean, I just can't get over the quality of this finish and the manner in which it was completely unexpected. So much so, Doyle, that I was watching Edwin Cerrillo after he scores it. He has no idea what to do. None. He's just, it's like one of those moments where you're like, okay, do I run this way? I'm going to go this way. No, I'm going to change direction now. What do I do with my hands? It was so amazing. It was so indicative of this rivalry of El Tráfico, which is now averaging more than 4 goals per game and got 6 in this one.
I think this was the best El Tráfico. Jeez, I can't. This might be the best El Tráfico since they met in the playoffs back in, was it 19? And that one was 5-3. It might have to go back to 2018. Might have to go back to the original game. This is certainly the best comeback since that original game. You're right to focus on that Cerrillo goal. I love a hammered shot from distance in which there's no backlift. Like he didn't have to wind up and take six steps to generate that power. He somehow found it with like one step bang. I think we're going to dive into this game a little bit more later on in the show. But like it was a great moment for him. Obviously, it's a great moment for the Galaxy. I have thoughts on what it all means or maybe doesn't mean, but I think we're going to be able to go back and forth on that a little bit.
I was just so happy for Edwin because he has been sort of this unsung hero all year. I remember even when he was traded from Dallas last year, I was like, wait, but why?
Yeah.
And now it makes perfect sense. Like they needed a guy whose singular focus was doing the defensive dirty work, and he has done that all season long for this team. And it's often been easier for him with Mark Delgado in there. But, you know, I Anders goaded me into sending out the Jon Snow meme when the lineups came out, and it was Marco Reus and Ricky Puig ahead of him against LAFC on the counter. And it's the meme where Jon Snow is unsheathing the shield against the onrushing hordes. I thought he was in for one of those games where it's like, dude, you're going to have to be super human, like literally undead. And somehow he did it, even with a little bit of a blip as well that he made up for. More on that in a minute. Honorable mention, because I can never do one thing and best thing you saw. That TIFO in Cincinnati, it was the best part of the Hell is Real match. I mean, from the actual sort of banner itself, you can never leave Sin City, C-I-N City. And then behind it, the card stunt, it really was one of those moments where you're just like, hey, this is one of the best rivalries in this part of the world. And these fans get it. They're ready for it. They understand the stakes. The teams are good. This is a golden moment for Hell is Real, even if the match was a tiny bit of a stinker. We'll get to that in a second. Okay. We've done it all. We've still not talked Messi in depth, so let's just do it. The Philadelphia Union, desperate for playoff points, go to Miami, go to Chase Stadium, and Doyle, they poked the bear. They poked him. They got an early goal from Mikel Uwe, and we all sort of gasped when we saw Lionel Messi in the starting lineup, and now I feel like an absolute idiot for doing so. If Messi was healthy, if he wanted to start, if he thought he could play, hell, 45 minutes, let alone 60 or the 90 that he did, there was no way Tata was going to keep it out. So the Union poked the bear, and then Lionel Messi turned around and put on a clinic. Inter Miami have now picked up 27 points from losing positions in MLS this season. They just keep on rolling, and now they have the GOAT.
We should have known that he would play 90 in his return because he knows his body so well and he desperately wants to be out there. And this wasn't like his debut last year, because remember, he came off the bench for that game against Cruz Azul for the last 30, and he was very outspoken leading up to that game saying, like, I haven't been training this summer at the level I usually am. I'm not going to be able to play more than 15 minutes. Of course, he played 30, but like there's a difference between that and like, yeah, I got injured in the middle of my season, but I've dealt with that before. I know how to come back and be 90 minutes fit. And it's exactly what happened. And he's the greatest soccer player any of us have ever seen. You know, he harvested poor Jack Elliott's soul on that first goal where Philly's was shape.
Was it Kai Wagner?
It was Kai Wagner. You're right.
Whoever's soul was going into the down below.
It was one of those things where Philly just got their shape got messed up a little bit by Miami's buildup, which wasn't even a super intentional buildup, and allowed Jordi Alba to sort of stride through central midfield with nobody picking him up. And this is maybe, you know, if Jose Martinez was there, maybe that's a little bit different.
Hell, Danley Jean-Jacques. I mean, he was out right in this game, and so was Andre Blake.
Right. And because of that, you just get Messi on the ball in zone 14, and that's death. That's death. And that was the first one. And the second one was just a classic Messi goal where, you know, he releases the pass, and then somehow nobody tracks him, and he gets, you know, in that sort of second six between the penalty spot and the 18, and he one times finish with that left foot. He's scored that goal 500 times in his career, and it was like, oh, Miami don't need to play well for 90 minutes. They don't even need to play well for 30 minutes. And honestly, in this game, they didn't. They just need to play well for 10, 15 minutes and they put two on the board, and it's going to get easier and easier now that this guy is back in the lineup.
And then he sets up Suarez for a goal. He sets up Suarez for another goal in which he is like 6 to 8 inches offside, but offside nonetheless. The first one, I don't blame Kai Wagner for diving in on Messi's left foot.
No, not at all.
I don't know what you're supposed to do ultimately in that scenario. It's just a lose-lose situation for Wagner. And then the second goal, one, it's Alba again. And you said 500 times he scored it. Well, if that's the case, 300 of those times it came from Jordi Alba playing that exact same ball. But that ball doesn't get the credit it deserves because the finish is so good. The way he just sort of wands it past Andrew Rick, and he's going to the near post, but he sends it to the back post, but with enough power and at the right level where it's almost impossible for the goalkeeper to get even just a little bit of a glancing touch on it. But that pass doesn't get enough credit, Doyle. That lane is extremely small, and it can go at one pace to get through and to reach Messi at the right pace for Messi to apply the finish. And Jordi Alba is just like in the laundry list of game-changing ballers on this team. You know, he's like vacillating between second and fifth or sixth, and that is stupid. Like, yeah. It is stupid what this Miami team has done, what they've built. I mean, if you look at this game, David Martinez got hurt again. And we talk about Messi and Suarez and everything that they do, and Diego Gomez, who I thought actually had an off game, same thing with Redondo. But then Noah Allen comes in for David Martinez and just keeps it going. And then Noah Allen gets hurt, and they bring in Ian Frey. And I was thinking about this team, and the thing that just kept coming into my mind before the game, after the game, basically throughout the entire season, is that Inter Miami are the most talented, they're the deepest, they're the most resilient. Yeah, it goes to this 27 points they've picked up. They're the most solution-oriented team in MLS play ever. And when I say solution-oriented, I mean within game, but I also mean just within the organization. If there is a problem, if there is an absence, if there is an injury, if there is fill-in-the-blank problem, Inter Miami have gone out and fixed it, and they've done it at the highest level they can possibly can under the rules, and they've done it as fast as they can. It has been an absolute clinic in building and maintaining what is absolutely a historic team. And I take that all the way back. It's not just this year. It's not just Chris Henderson. It's the Moss brothers. It's David Beckham. It's all the setup to get Lionel Messi so that all these other dominoes fall the way that they do, whether it's Busquets and Suarez and Alba and Redondo and Gomez, or, you know, Farias in the first place, or whatever, fill in the blank. Everything that they've done, it's been a slow burn that's just picked up momentum. Like, they haven't made a mistake. Like, I'm trying to think of a big mistake that this club has made. Like, you get Messi, you sign Tata, you go get Busquets, you go get Suarez. What's the big mistake?
Outside of the first couple years.
In the past 2 years,
there haven't been any. There were a lot of big mistakes those first 3 years.
Don't even worry about those days, Doyle. That is not even the same club. Like, come on now.
No, but the last 2 years, they've mostly done it right. I still have questions, though. I don't think they played well. Toto Avilés was a disaster. Like, he gifted the Union that first goal, and he tried to gift them two or three more. Sergio Busquets had one of his worst games of the year. I'm not concerned about Busquets, but like Avilés.
And it doesn't matter, Doyle. Both those guys are suspended for a trip to Atlanta. Do you think it matters? Do you think they're going to lose that game?
I mean, Atlanta already chewed them up once this year.
Atlanta just got chewed up by Nashville at home. Atlanta are walking dead.
Yeah. Look,
just one more point I want to make on this team and on the job that Tata has done, and then maybe we can debate whether Tata or Wilfred will win coach of the year. Tata has played 30 players in 2024. 28 players have made a start for a team chasing the points record who will probably get it. 25 players have made more than one start. Only 12 players have played more than 1,000 minutes. Just 12. If you look at the minute distribution, if you look at the contributions up and down this roster, it is not just Messi, who has barely played more than 1,100 minutes. It is not just Suarez. It is not just these U22 players who started as prospects or youth national teamers in South America and have evolved and developed into some of the best players in that region, particularly in the case of Diego Gomez. It is all the guys we've talked about all year. It's Ian Frey. It's Noah Allen. It's Yannick Bright. It's, you know, Leo Afonso. It's absurd what this entire squad has managed to do and has managed to do without Messi for 105 days until now. They're going to win the Shield, not because of Lionel Messi. That might be the points record. They're going to win the Shield because of what they could do without Lionel Messi. and it's absurd.
I agree with that 100% across the board. Like literally everything you just said, they are going to win the Shield, and they would have done so with or without Messi. Getting him back for this stretch run raises the ceiling and makes it harder to define what success is, because we're at the point now where just winning the Shield is not a successful season for Inter Miami.
I was against you on this. I completely agree. They got to get the points record. They got to.
Yep. With him back, and even though there are questions about central defense, which, like, let's just jump into it now. David Martinez got hurt again, which is a shame because I think he's clearly the best center back on that team. Toto Alvilas has not developed over the past year in the way that I think they helped.
I agree.
Sergi Kristoff didn't even make the bench, has not played well this year. Ian Frey is getting minutes. Noah Allen, as you said, came in, gave them, I thought, really good minutes against the Union, then came out injured.
I believe it's a head injury as well. So that could be one, you hope it's not bad for him, just personally. And two, that could be complicated for them as far as personnel going forward.
Yeah. I don't love the way they've played. They give up a ton of chances, and it's self-inflicted in a way that, look, when the crew screw up playing out of the back, it's almost something it comes from their patterns of build out.
It's by design.
Right.
In some ways. Yeah.
It's a risk that is baked in with the way Miami was, like, they tried to gift the Union at least a point in this game. If they play like this against the crew in a couple of weeks, they'll lose 5-2. So this has been ongoing, and I kept expecting it to get better. And through injuries and, you know, international duty and absences, it really hasn't. And it might not matter, right? They might set the points record anyway. They might win MLS Cup anyway, but at no point has it felt like, oh, it's all together and it's all clicking and they all have complete control of this game.
I agree. It's not the safest ride in the world, right? It might be the most exhilarating. It's it's kind of like riding a roller coaster, and right before they hit go, they're like, hey, but there's a chance that the screws on your seat are not actually secured in a way that keep you on this roller coaster when you go upside down. Like, it could all fall out. I just have a hard time seeing it happen when you have Lionel Messi playing like this, because you can give other teams opportunities. You can go down. And for a lot of teams, that's it. That's curtains. Like, okay, we're down from an emotional standpoint. We can't deal with it. You know, just from a capability standpoint of coming back, we don't have the guns. Miami have all those things. And I don't think it's just a points record anymore. Tata Martino talked about, you know, trying to win everything. And that was the expectation for this team. And no team in MLS history has ever faced this kind of pressure. And all of that is absolutely true. I think for Miami, the rest of the way, if they don't set a points record and win MLS Cup, maybe disappointment is a strong word, but I think it's an accurate one.
I don't think that's wrong. I think the expectation when you have Lionel Messi is that you win every competition you play for.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. That's it. And that's what you sign up for when you bring in the greatest player of all time and three of his closest friends and make signings like Redondo and Diego Gomez. Like, this is not a team built to almost get there. This is a team built to win everything. And if they set the points record and then lose to the crew or lose in the final to one of the LA teams, nobody's going to talk about, oh, they set the points record and won the Shield. Everybody's going to talk about the trophies they didn't win. Because remember, they got buried by Monterrey in CONCACAF Champions Cup, and that was testy. They got beat by Columbus in League's Cup, even though Columbus gifted them an early goal. And then if they win the Shield but don't win MLS Cup, then they're going to hear it. They're going to hear it, and it's going to be a disappointment. And I don't think that's wrong.
Think of the biggest teams, the biggest moments, and think of the images associated with those teams. You could go worldwide, you know, Messi at the World Cup. You could go in MLS, and I think back to the David Beckham falling to his knees when he and the Galaxy finally got it over the line, where his enduring legacy prior to that had been that he had sort of, did he want to be there? Did he not want to be there? And was the Galaxy going to improve and become a championship contender again with him there? And then once they did, that this iconic image, That's what Messi and Miami need. They need the iconic image. Let's just, before we get to MLS Cup, we'll have months to figure all that out. Still a ways away. I mean, early December, what, we're September 16th. It feels pressing and urgent, but it's not. Let's just try to plot out if they'll get to 74 real quick. At Atlanta, midweek.
I mean, they're going to be favorites, as you said.
Give me a point total. Just give me a point total.
I think they get it done.
3 points. Three points. At New York City.
3 points.
6 points total. They need six more. Charlotte at home.
3 points.
9 points. At Columbus.
0 points.
0 points. They're still at nine. At Toronto.
3 points.
12 points. They just set the points record with New England home on the final day. Could set a points record. New total by 4 points if they do that.
Yeah.
And that all seems very reasonable. It all does. Well, let me ask you this before we get to Philly. Is it reasonable? And I brought this up at the end of the wrap up. We didn't have time to discuss it, but we got all the time in the world on extra time. Is Lionel Messi a legitimate threat to win the MLS MVP award?
So if his name appears on the ballot, he's going to win it because people are just going to vote for him. When I decide the MVP, it's his, is he the best player? Is he on one of the best teams?
So yes and yes. I think you can just say yes and yes there.
Correct. And did the team stumble without him? And did he play a lot of minutes?
No, and yes, no.
And yes to the first two. No and no to the last two. If I would have trouble voting for someone who only played 1,600 regular season minutes. If Lucho Acosta scores two more goals and four more assists, and since he finished second in the Eastern Conference, I would probably struggle to vote for anybody besides Lucho Acosta.
I agree with you. That's where my mind is too. And I also agree with you that if Messi's on the ballot and they set a points record and he balls out in this way the rest of the way and he ends up, I mean, hell, he could end up winning the Golden Boot, Doyle. He's got 14 goals, 14 assists. The only guy with more goals plus assists right now is Lucho. And the margin ain't that big. Like, Messi could go win the Golden Boot. And because 19 games in MLS so far, and that includes 2023 when he was hurt coming off Leagues Cup and really wasn't at his best. He's got 15 goals, 15 assists in 19 games. And my brain immediately went to, how many guys in the history of Major League Soccer have 15 and 15 in a single season? Numbers that Messi has in 19 games, many of which were hurt last year and some of which this year.
Can I take a guess?
Did you watch the show? So just
no, I didn't. I watched the show, but I don't think I saw that part. I seem to recall that that Javinka was the first one to do it. Or was he the first one to go? Was he the first to go 20 and 15?
I believe that's the case. Jovinko is correct. Jovinko did it twice. So there's actually five seasons of 15 and 15 in MLS history. You have two. So Sebastian Jovinko.
Vela did it once.
Yes, in his historic campaign in 2019. That's correct.
So do we have to go back to Preki?
Preki didn't quite get there.
He had like a 14 and 18.
Yeah, there's season. A number of guys that hit 14 on one of the two metrics, goals or assists, and just didn't quite get there.
I don't think Landon did it.
Nope.
And I don't think Jaime Moreno did it.
Did not. Jaime Moreno, though, if you go back to that era, you'll get the other two. I'll give you that hint.
Jason Kreis?
Jason Kreis did it.
So we're talking original era. Oh, boy, I'm embarrassing myself by not getting this.
I mean, the fact that you have these, I don't think you could embarrass yourself when it comes to...
You're going to have to tell me the last one because I'm blanking.
I'm going to just, how about 15 and 15 for the 2001?
2001.
Playing in the state of Florida.
Oh, El Humvee, Diego Serna.
Diego Serna. Yeah, 15 and 15 in 2001. Those are the four players that have done in one complete season what Messi has now done In 19 games.
Yeah, and he was our good buddy Mark Connolly, who does all the stats and research for us. He has the data. 19 games is obviously the fastest ever to get to 15 and 15. Second fastest ever was Giovinco, who got there in 29 games. So Messi was 10 games faster.
And this is it was me and Mark nerding out basically while watching the games. And I just turned to Mark and I just said, 15 and 15, huh? I wonder how many other guys have done that. And me and Sasha did our best to get those names. We had Vela and Giovinco. We did not get Kreis or Serna, but man, that tells you it just tells you what happens when the greatest player of all time puts his flag on North American soil. Real quick, what are the odds of Philly making the playoffs after this particular result for them? They are now in the Eastern Conference in 11th, 30 points, 3 points back of DC. They do have a game in hand on DC, but their schedule is as follows: at New York City, DC at home, Atlanta at home, at Orlando, at Columbus, Cincinnati at home.
Do we know Andre Blake's status?
I don't know long term. I have not seen Jim Curtin talk about how long he thinks this might take for him to get back.
If Andre Blake is hurt, their chance of making the playoffs is like 10% or less. If Andre Blake is healthy, I think it's better than a coin flip. I honestly think Andre Blake saves that second goal that Messi scores. So it's just like he's been the difference all year. You could see the on off when he's in there, Philly pick up points at like a top four pace in the Eastern Conference. When he's not, they pick up points much more sporadically.
And that's not a dig at Andrew Rick, the homegrown goalkeeper.
He was 18 years old. He wasn't bad at all. He just didn't make a save that arguably the greatest goalkeeper in MLS history would have made.
It's funny. It's one of those, like, if you're a goalkeeper and probably goalkeepers out there are groaning, like, you idiot. No. Like, if Messi scores two on me, do I try to take one of those balls and, like, boot it to my family in the stands? You know, hey, hold on to that. Keep that for me. That's a souvenir. All right, let's keep it moving here. Any thoughts on Miami and their historic campaign? You let us know. I know you love when we talk about Messi and Miami and the boys.
By the way, I just want to get it on the record here. I picked Miami to do the double at the start of the season. And even though I have my reservations and I think that Columbus have played better soccer this year, and I think that LAFC are potentially a nightmare matchup for Miami because Miami gives the ball away a ton, and that's how LAFC do work, I am still standing by Miami to do the double. I am not stupid enough to pick against a healthy Lionel Messi.
Breaking news, Matt Doyle stands by the take that Matt Doyle will be right about who wins the double. No, I'm brave.
Yeah.
Hell is real. Failed the launch a little bit. Scoreless draw, but the crew and Cincy both booked their spots into the playoffs, Doyle. I mean, that was sort of, we knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
It was just a matter of time. My take on this game is sort of like the 2-1 win for Cincinnati earlier in the year. The crew had the better chances. The crew played the better soccer. But Cincinnati put up one of those defensive performances that we've just been waiting for. Their pressure was good. They, uncharacteristically, at least for teams playing the crew, had an equal share of the ball. And they kept the crew from creating in mass. And then in the big moments, either Celentano stood up big or the crew just missed chances. I thought this was an absolutely brilliant result for Cincinnati. And that sounds kind of strange when you have a scoreless draw at home against your biggest rival.
Yeah, I'm with you. Here's a question I have, because I agree with you that this was a really good defensive performance, which is exactly what Cincinnati needed and what we haven't seen from them basically since Matt Miazga got hurt. If you were Pat Noonan, would you be happier to take the 0-0 at home against a team as good at in attack as Columbus, or would you have been happier with a 4-3 win where it's like, okay, it's a shootout, I guess we have to try to outscore them?
4-3 win. Win, because I think the biggest issue long term for them right now, just my opinion, I think this group can figure out how to get back to that sort of defensive identity that they've had, especially because Miles Robinson and Ian Murphy were both suspended. So when Miles Robinson and Ian Murphy come back into that back line, and it's not Yedlin at right center back, and it's not Alvis Powell at left center back, just personnel-wise, you're better. Now Yedlin gets to play on the right, or Ashano gets to play on the left, or he gets to move up into attack, and that starts to fix some of the issues I think they have just in terms of chance creation, where it really has become the Lucho show. Oh, and we hope that Yu Yakubo can play up top, but he had to play left wing back in this game, so he wasn't in the positions to be, you know, productive as a forward, and Kelsey's not being that guy, and Joachini has not yet been that guy, though he's better defensively. To me, for the ceiling for Cincinnati, it's more about the attack getting back to a measure of like at least average or above average than it is about the back line, because I think the back line can get there if the personnel issues just calm down a tiny bit.
See, I'm more worried about the floor because I'm not as convinced as you are about the personnel issues. Like, Chidozie Awuzie hasn't been great since they got him. The Miles Robinson has been in and out of the lineup. It's still not clear what their back three is going to be. So I was worried about the floor falling away. Whereas if Lucho's back healthy and Luca Orellano is out there healthy, I'm not as worried about their ability to find goals. I think that they will be able to create that just from those guys having the ball. And if you put a center forward out there with good movement, like Yuya Kubo, or I think Joe Keeney's movement off the ball is very good, like, they're going to find chances, and eventually some of those are going to go in the back of the net.
But to me, that comes from the personnel getting right, because then you can actually have Yuya Kubo up there. You can actually have Orellano feel like he's secure and pushing into positions higher up the field. I mean, there's a lot. The dominoes here for Columbus have basically been scattered all year, and anytime Pat Noonan gets two put together to try to knock them down, all of a sudden they get knocked back away. It's been an absurd season for Cincinnati, and here's the stat that backs that up. I asked Noonan when I talked to him last week. I was like, do you know how many identical 11s you've played this year? And I didn't know the answer. I just was curious if he did, because I was going to go do the research. And then FC Cincinnati's PR staff was like, oh, we did the research. Here you go. Not a single time this season, Doyle, in terms of personnel and position, and that's an important qualifier, personnel and position, so the same 11, the same positions, in all competitions for the crew or for Cincy, they haven't played it once. That's an absurd amount of change, and that includes beginning of the season when they had a bunch of new starters that they were integrating. That goes into the middle of the season when Matt Miazga goes down, and then all these other injuries start to accumulate, including Lucho. And it goes into this post-transfer window period where they've had to add new pieces and integrate them as well. Oh, and by the way, it includes Aaron Bupinza, who basically got himself knocked out of MLS literally and figuratively. Like, I would say this to you, and I said it to Kaylin Kyle and BWP, and they basically laughed me off the studio. I think Pat Noonan and his staff have done a better coaching job in 2024 than they did in 2023 when Cincy won the Shield and Noonan was the coach of the year. It is an inherently, by definition, a different job. That team in 2023 was on an upward trajectory. It was healthy. It was settled. The roles were clear. That team had developed together. They had taken steps to become a winner together. And they made a huge step to go out and get it done. But they really didn't have, like, foundational change during the season that I remember. Maybe your memory is better.
The only one was adding Bupinza. Right. That was the big thing that they had to adjust for, especially because it became really clear really early that Barriel was going to be able to play as a left wing back. And that was a bit of really good coaching at the start of the season. But it was a hot rod. That team last year was a supporter shield contending team that mostly had good health and won the supporter shield because of it. I didn't vote for Pat Noonan, but it's not like he was undeserving. He did a fantastic job. This year's been much, the degree of difficulty is much more difficult, much higher. They sold Brandon Vasquez. Bupinza got himself tuned up, and
Barrial left. Bringing Orellano into the team, there was no guarantee that he was going to be this guy. And oh, by the way, they've asked him to play wing back on both sides and the number 10, and had to move him all over the field. Bupinza was a nothing burger / cancer. It's been last year they had all these difference makers, and then Lucho could just be the conductor. This year, Lucho's basically had to be, outside of some really good moments from Orellano and Yuya Kubo, but sort of unexpected in terms of the amount of production, he's had to be the whole orchestra at times.
Yep. And I just think it's been a tougher season for Cincinnati. And the fact that they're still cruising along in second place in the Eastern Conference and on track for like 65 points, Noonan's done a better job this year than he did last year. And last year he did an excellent job.
The way I think about it is, given Cincinnati's history, given the change, given the variability of Major League Soccer, the odds that they stay at the top of the East are probably, if you're just mathematical, the odds of staying at the top of the East are probably less than having a drop down into the like fourth, fifth, sixth position, just given the injuries. The fact that they've stayed and they've held that standard, that is the ultimate test in this league. How many great teams have become good or mediocre teams after they've had to turn their entire team over, or they've had to sell their best forward and their second best attacking player, or they've had a designated player who was a nothing burger. Like what they have done is absolutely crazy. And I went back and looked at all the lineups. Again, I was just nerding out on this, and I've half convinced myself that even though he's missed half the year, that Matt Miazga might be the defender of the year. 11 of 16 wins in this team, despite all the rotation, came with Matt Miazga. He might have actually been, with him and Lucho, like two of the most irreplaceable players in the entire league in terms of just what they bring their team and the effect that it has on their teammates.
So where are you then on Cincy overall having replaced the irreplaceable in Matt Miazga? Like, how confident are you in a back three of Ian Murphy, Awadziam, and Miles Robinson?
Have they done it? They haven't done it. They haven't replaced Matt Miazga. I still think it's better than, 80% of the rest of the league. You know, I wouldn't be too hard on Awadziam personally. He just walked into a team that has been in disarray personnel-wise, not in terms of culture or in terms of, you know, what they're trying to do or the coaching, but in terms of personnel, yes. The relationships around him have changed repeatedly, and they haven't been like, oh, this guy's in his best position now. It's been, oh, crap, we have to fill another hole. DeAndre and Alvis, please come play center back with us for one more game. So I think if you can settle down the relationships, if it's Ian, Awadziam, and Miles Robinson the rest of the way, and they can build those relationships and just get guys into positions of comfort and repeatability, this team can go win MLS Cup. Do I think they would be the odds-on favorite to get out of the East? I don't. I think that would be the Crew and Inter Miami, and by a decent margin. But they're in a position to do something special. And after they missed on their big DP signing in the winter, after Bupenza failed and had to be moved on, and after Miazga got hurt, I think that's a credit to the entire staff. Here's a trivia for you real quick. The Crew have either been matched or lost the possession battle three times in MLS this year. Cincinnati, with this team, was one of them. Who were the other two?
I know NYCFC did it.
Yes, that's correct. The first one might surprise you. Very early on in the season, another team that has experienced foundational turnover this season. Atlanta United.
Oh, really?
Yeah, first game of the season.
Oh,
those
wow.
are the only three teams.
Oh,
only
wow.
three teams. All right. Let's talk Crew. We've really gone in on Cincy there. Any concern for you? Any concern at all?
Mostly no. They've been shut out two straight games, but last week was that weird international date game against the Sounders, and I think you just picked that one up and put it in the trash. And this one was a highly motivated Cincinnati side at home doing everything in their power to get a shutout. And I thought Columbus actually played well. The only hint of a worry is that Darlington Nagbe hasn't quite looked right the past 2 weeks. He was terrible against Seattle. If you look at the red card that defined that game, it was Christian Roldan pressing Nagbe into a bad turnover. And that sort of defined the game. And in this game, he wasn't terrible, but he wasn't good. He wasn't dynamic in any real way. And he's 34, and you pulled the numbers on this, Weeby. He's logged a lot of minutes because as great as Wilfred Nancy is as a head coach, he keeps his squad small. And maybe given the number of games Columbus have played, that's starting to wear them down a little bit, especially because, again, Nagbe is mid-30s.
The number is more than 1,000 minutes, or 3,000 minutes, I should say, in all competitions for Darlington. Diego Rossi is above 3,000. He leads the team in minutes. Steven Moreira is almost there. Same with Patrick Schulte. Same with Rudy Camacho. Cucho Hernandez has played 2,600. Zawadzki's played 2,500. Mo Farsi's played 2,400. It's a small squad. That's the way Wilfred Nancy wants his squad. He likes it small. He likes, you know, to have guys he trusts. He doesn't want to go through some big group all the time. He's said this to me many times. But, you know, we went back and I told you about the numbers for Inter Miami and the distribution of minutes. And a lot of that's been injury. But for the Crew, you have 15 players over 1,000 minutes in the league. One player over 500 minutes, that's Jason Russell Rowe. And then just nine others who's played more than 100, less than 500. So you're talking about 16 players on that first number over 500 minutes.
And one of those is Middleborough now, right? Aiden Morris got sold.
Aiden Morris. Meanwhile, there are 20 on Inter Miami, and it just feels like they have less wear and tear than the Crew. And I don't know if that'll matter, but I do know that the Crew, given their schedule, given the way games were pushed back, and they'll have to play in Campeones Cup, and then they'll have to play on that international date weekend in October, and then they'll have to, just like everybody else, play 2 to 3 games in the first round and on through the playoffs. I do wonder if fatigue will play a role at some point for this team.
I feel like it has played a role the last 2 weeks, specifically with Nagby. And I do wonder, I mean, one of the big disappointments, I think, is that Derek Jones hasn't been able to blossom this year under Wilfried Nancy in the way that we hoped going into this season. If he had been able to play 1,500 minutes instead of just 500 minutes, that would make things feel really different. And is it too late to get him out there with the first team? Would you be confident going into Wednesday's game if it's Derek Jones and Sean Zawadzki?
I think the ship sailed, man.
I think you're right.
It feels to me like the ship sailed. And, you know, Dylan Chambos was sort of signed for that, right? That's why a guy like that is there.
Yep.
We'll see with the Crew. We'll see. They're so talented. Their best moments are better than anyone else's best moments. This team, when they're playing and everything's rolling and they're firing on cylinders, for me, the top team in Major League Soccer, sometime outside factors play a role. We'll see. All right, El Tráfico. It took us a long time to get here, which is either a credit to us or a demerit on us. The Galaxy prove a point after going down 2-0. Bob Ramsey tweeted me after I said, hey, everybody's trying to avoid the LA Galaxy in the Western Conference playoff. He said, avoid the LA Galaxy? Puts on an old man voice. I haven't heard that phrase in many, many years. It's been a while, Doyle, but here they are, 7-point leaders at the top of the West, thanks to a 4-2 win against LAFC. But it was almost a disaster. In fact, it was a disaster for 45 minutes. We both watched this game back. We both have some thoughts. Let's dig into those. Let's get nerdy. What was the issue for you as the Galaxy went down to a Denny Bawanga goal and a Bogush goal? What was the problem?
Structural silliness that compounded individual errors. And it was the same story that we've seen play out again and again in El Tráfico over the past couple of years. Coming into this game, LAFC had won 4 of the past 5 El Tráficos. In most of those games, they scored early. I think in most of those games, they scored first. And anytime they did that, they were able to then pad the lead because they're so dynamic and devastating on the counterattack. And the Galaxy didn't seem to have watched any film. Came out in a 4-3-3 single pivot. Ricky Pooj was wandering all over, and he had a couple of bad turnovers that turned into LAFC goals inside the first 15 minutes. Those turnovers were compounded by the fact that Miki Yamani, who's on Denny Bawanga's side, was playing as a hug the touchline, get up really high, and stretch the field both vertically and horizontally type of fullback. And when you do that, your center back is going to have to go defend Denny Bawanga 1v1 at full speed in the channel. And it was insane to me, and it kept being that way even after it was 2-0. It happened, I think, 2 or 3 more times in the first half, and I was shocked at, I think, the naivete of the Galaxy's game plan. And then in the second half, you know, they went in, and you know, the main tactical adjustment was the play better tactical adjustment. But the other one was that they went from a single pivot to a double. Ricky played more as an 8 next to Edwin Cerrillo. Marco Royce was playing central as kind of a true number 10 in a 4-2-3-1. And Yamane, instead of being an overlapping fullback, would either pinch inside. Like when Ricky goes walkabout, Yamane would pinch inside to become a second sort of central midfielder to help blunt any attacks up the gut. And when Ricky was sort of playing in that true number 8 role instead of going walkabout, Yamane was just shading towards Denny Bawanga and almost shadowing him. So he was in good position to stop any counterattacks. And the Galaxy, through that solidity and then through having some very special players, including Dejan Jovalić, who was awesome, played their best half of the year and absolutely crushed LAFC. And I'm not sure I feel any differently about these two teams after this game as I did before.
Interesting, because I feel a good amount different about the Galaxy.
Why? We've seen this from the Galaxy before this year. I remember
the second half was different. And let me explain it.
No, we in week three, I remember writing in my column about the Galaxy's rest defense and how much better it looked because Yamane was coming inside and they were doing all the stuff that they did in the second half of this game. And like, yet they started this game with Yamane nowhere near Denny Bwanga.
So I have some quibbles with the way that you have portrayed Yamane's role. I think Yamane in both halves was designed and was tucking inside to become a de facto central midfielder in possession. And so on the first goal, to me, this is on him. He is way too far upfield, way too far. Like he is further than Marco Reus on this play as it's sort of a transition 50-50 moment. And Edwin Cerillo makes an individual error. He can't be cute. And he was cute in the moment and they lost the ball and Ricky Pooj doesn't react. So to me, that was the worst moment for Miki Yamane. Positionally, he was far too advanced upfield. He expected his team to be clean on the ball, and they weren't. But he was tucked inside still, because when Miki Yamane tucks inside, it opens up the entry ball to Gabriel Peck to his feet, and that's what the Galaxy want. They want that ball. They want Yamane as somebody to bounce it back to, and then they want that possession hub, because, look, Marco Reus's movement is going to cause everybody problems, so that Marco Reus can move off of that sort of possession pattern. On the second goal, I didn't think Yamane was high at all. I thought he was actually in good position to shut this play down. Another transition moment, Ricky wins the ball. What are you doing, Ricky Pooj? Like, this was not a structural issue. It was an individual issue. Ricky just passes it to LAFC and eliminates himself and four other attackers. Okay, bad situation. Now you've got to keep the ball from going to Denny Bwanga. Yamane is not on the touchline. He is not wide. That's where Gabriel Peck wants to be when they're in buildup. He's actually inside but advanced in front of the back line. He has every opportunity to get in between the ball and Denny Bwanga. He just doesn't do it. It's inexplicable. When you go back and watch this play, all Yamane would have to do is to have a little bit more urgency, two or three more steps to shut down the passing angle. Because again, he's inside. He's not on the touchline. And then there's an opportunity to challenge Tillman to prevent the pass to Denny Bwanga. And LAFC is triggered on one thing. When those central midfielders, particularly the 2-8s, get the ball, they are going to look to release Denny Bwanga. You have to put them under pressure. So LA Galaxy, I don't think it was structural. I think it was more in terms of their aggression and then the reaction that you have to have when you counter press and you lose the ball against LAFC. It has to be immediate. And you have to know that the danger is Denny Bwanga. You've got to slow that down. They didn't slow it down at all. I actually thought they didn't. Basically the same stuff in the second half, though I do completely agree with you that Greg Vanney clearly told Miki Yamane, yo, stop wandering so far forward. Just stop it. If you stay a little bit deeper, you're in position on the counter press to slow the entry ball to Bwanga or shut it down, or you can shadow him, which I again agree with you. He did often at times when they turned the ball over. But I'm not sure that Ricky was playing as a dual eight. Off the ball, he was always as a 10 with Reus up in front, and they tried to pressure them. And then when the LA Galaxy got the ball, because they were more ball secure, think of the Crew and Houston, two teams at BLFC, way more ball secure, he could drop in, and he loves to drop into that little channel in front of Yoshida, either receive the ball and bounce it back or receive it and dribble and turn. And he gotten way more instances where he got back and got on the ball. I think he dropped back into those positions in possession as opposed to starting in them. And then once he was there, when Ricky faces you, if he doesn't make bonehead decisions, he's just so freaking special at finding feet or beating somebody on his own and creating attacking momentum. And when this team gets going now with Ricky, with Reus moving in front of him, with Pooj on the right, with no Paintsil, but Fagundes was solid in this game, and then Dejan Jovlic as a focal point, they will kill you. And they absolutely killed LAFC in the second half, and they got their counter press right. When they lost the ball, which they did plenty, they were close to the LAFC players. They got close to Denny Bwanga. They didn't give him space to run. And so I actually thought that, I don't know, I'll be curious to ask Greg Vanney about the first and second half and structural and, you know, tactical changes he made. I didn't think they were that much different. I just thought they executed their plan way better.
So here's what Vanney said. In the first half, Bwanga kept getting a lot of open space and running at Jalen Neal. It's not a great matchup for us. We didn't want to be in that. So just some different things that I feel like we had to adjust structurally and then see opportunity. And then the guys had to just go for it. And they did. So he does say specifically that they changed the structure.
And yeah, maybe I think that's Yamane, to your point. I do think that's Yamane.
Yeah, maybe that's just, but I like just looking at the way the second half played out and then looking at the heat maps, like Ricky was playing as a true eight in that second half. And then the other thing is Royce was sort of orienting his movement towards Ricky. And you saw it play out in the way they were able to connect in the first half when they were really playing a single pivot and, you know, free eights, those both those guys playing as free eights. They weren't they only connected eight times, or Ricky only completed eight passes to Marco Royce. In the second half, Ricky completed 16 passes to Marco Royce. And I think that just comes from having them playing on sort of different levels, right? In a 4-2-3-1 versus a 4-3-3. And I'm sure Greg Vanney would say it was a 4-3-3 in both halves, but whatever you want to call it, they were not playing the same position in the second half. And I think in the first, they were. And you know, however you want to paint it, it felt like good adjustments. And then a gut check.
I agree.
It was a gut check moment for this team because they had been significantly worse than LAFC in all five halves the teams had played up to that point that far. The flip side, Steve Tarundolo after the match said, first of all, it didn't really feel like a derby, didn't feel too intense, and second of all, made the point that his team's played a lot more games and because they made that long Leagues Cup run and that a lot of his guys were coming back from long flights because of the international date and that showed up in their legs in the second half. And honestly, I get a little tired of Steve Tarundolo's excuses. These strike me as reasonable.
Yeah, I think they are reasonable. We saw Dini Bawang in the first half. Again, when he got in those positions where he has all this room to run and he can be his best self, be super effective. But I was like, Steve said he got back on Friday. And so I was like, how long did it take Dini Bawanga to get back? He was in Libreville, I believe, in Gabon for the, Libreville. I don't know. He was in Gabon for the international break. I looked up what the average flight times were back to LA. It was between 43 and 55 hours, Doyle, with four legs. It was absurd. It was absolutely absurd, and he wasn't the only one. Obviously, Bogus was coming back from Europe and so many others. Look, excuses for LAFC, I don't think the Galaxy care.
They shouldn't.
This was a prove-it game for both the Galaxy and Ricky, and I think in particular in maturity, in the ways that they've had these big, gaping, obvious flaws. You know, one of them is just emotionally and mentally, in particular against LAFC. Like, didn't respond well to getting punched in the mouth. And Greg Vanney knew it. If you go down to LAFC, you're in a bad spot. So to respond and get four goals in the second half and to not lose your desire to do the things that make you special, not to get fearful, not to over-index on, oh, crap, we can't stop this team in transition. Let's go conservative. They didn't do that. I thought was a real feather in their cap. And then to get the result and put the Western Conference in their own hands. Like, even with the games in hand now, with LAFC being exhausted, with LAFC not having a break basically through the rest of the season, like, the Galaxy could still control their own destiny. And that's really special, man. It's at Franceville, not Libreville. God.
So are you starting to worry about LAFC against good possession teams? Because we've seen them get crushed by the Crew twice. We saw them take 1 point out of six on offer against Houston and win only one of their last five against Houston. And now the Galaxy are definitely a possession team under Greg Vanney, but they clearly hit on something in that second half.
You have to say yes. I think you do.
Yeah.
But I just don't think there's that many of those teams, right? And so...
No, but like all the teams that they're going to have to beat.
Yeah, probably. But could you see the Galaxy somehow contriving to lose two out of three in the first round? Sure. I could see Absolutely. The Houston Dynamo doing that exact same thing. So there's variability to who they might face. What I don't get is what happened, because I know this was a priority for LAFC and it looked like they were turning the page in a lot of ways. So I'm confused as to what happened, why it didn't stick, why it didn't progress, why it didn't evolve, why they've gone so far back to this style. And maybe it is mileage. Maybe it is schedule. Maybe it is conserving energy. I don't know. I thought Giroud would be another sort of addition to that style of play rather than subtraction. And
agreed.
We haven't even said the Carlos Vela news, which give me sport's own Tom Bogert is saying is a done deal and Vela will return to LAFC for a swan song. Like maybe Vela can help them with that in games that they have a lead and they're trying to hold on to it, right? Like you bring him in for a guy like Bogush and he's more just like drop in and play off of him. You know, like he's possession wise, he would still be, I would think, their best player, but he won't be fit. He won't be match sharp. I don't, what happened? Like what happened?
Honestly, it looks like to me, like they got killed by the crew in that 5-1 and they tucked tail and ran away from the game model that had been so successful the first part of the year. And it leaves them vulnerable. Anytime you're giving teams 60% possession with a lot of it in your own defensive third, you're giving yourself a lot of opportunities to counter in theory, a lot of space to counter into in theory, but you're giving these teams a lot of chances to knock the ball around and create opportunities and create goals. And the crew did it, and Houston did it, and now the Galaxy did it. So I'm a little bit worried for LAFC. I don't think they can be this one note in the playoffs again. Maybe Steve Cherundolo thinks otherwise. Maybe it's just a matter of midseason fatigue. And now that he has most of his guys back healthy, they're going to go back to trying to use the ball a little bit more. I think that is the best version of LAFC, one that does that. I will say they still have a lot more knockout round, knockout game equity with me than the Galaxy do. If these two teams meet in the playoffs, whether it's in Carson or you know, in downtown LA, I'm still going to pick LAFC barring some sort of injury. I'm not saying it's a 100% lock guarantee. It's just I would still expect LAFC to beat the Galaxy in the playoffs if these two teams meet at full health.
I will say if the Galaxy finish in a better position in the standings, which it sure seems like they will, they have the best home record in Major League Soccer. And they have this little bit of, well, not little bit, this massive confidence boost to help them in that moment. By the way, the Carlos Vela news just dropped. He's in for the rest of the season, plus a club option for 2025. Guess he finally took that TAM deal, Doyle. Guess he finally did. All right, let's see. Race for the third and fourth spot in the West. We just talked to Houston Dynamo. Big win, 4-1 against RSL. RSL's bogey team is none other than the Houston Dynamo. They just keep losing big games against them. But Ace picked up a hamstring injury. Gosh, this is another one. It's like they beat LAFC, but Lawrence and Nolly picked up an injury. Yeah. I don't know how bad the hammy is, but that's not a good one to pick up with like 5 weeks left in the season.
It's a worry, but they have Coco Carrasquilla back, and Coco Carrasquilla's best position is the number eight. So you just slide him over, and then you use Latif Blessing as that sort of tight right winger, the spot that Coco Carrasquilla usually plays. And I think that's enough for down the stretch for this Houston team. Like, they have answers. They have a good roster. They do need Ace back come playoffs if they're going to win multiple.
Junior Moreno was a signing right at the roster deadline day as well. And you'll remember him from DC. And then, of course, the really good Cincinnati teams the last couple of years. He has time with Ben Olsen, so he'll be back, and that ought to help him with depth as well. But a really impressive win. I just want to shout out Griff Dorsey from this match. I thought he was really good. The goal he scores, Doyle, is one of those goals, if you're an MLS sicko, as you watch it happen, where they chip it over to the right wing back, which is Dorsey. He drives the entire field, decides he's a number 10, plays the ball into Ace on the left, and then scores the goal himself, decides he's the 9. I just had to stand up and golf clap that one. I just thought that was an absolutely incredible play. And the Houston Dynamo are fighting for fourth. Big head-to-head win, and a big head-to-head win for the Rapids against the Portland Timbers, who had been their bogey team. Wasn't it 2-4-1 wins for the Timbers against the Rapids? And this is a 2-1 victory for Chris Armas and his boys. And now they're in third place in the West. RSL's dropped down to fourth. And the battle for fourth is all of a sudden, well, it's extremely crowded out West. It's Colorado on 47, RSL on 47, Seattle on 46, Vancouver, who beat San Jose on 45, and the Dynamo on 44. And I've taken your breath away.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know where we're going with this.
I don't
because
either.
It's such a mess, and I can't bring myself to believe that second place is up for grabs, even though Colorado and RSL are only a point behind LAFC. LAFC do have a game in hand, but everything from 3 to 7, It's within 3 points. Seattle, Vancouver, Houston, Colorado, all playing really well. RSL falling well off the pace at this point. Chicho Arango is not the same guy he was. They have not figured out how to replace Andres Gomez. They're struggling to integrate Diego Gonzalez. Diego Luna has fallen off a little bit. So it's crisis time in RSL. Everybody else looks good. Portland 9-4-3 in their past 16 regular season games. I know that this was not a great result for them. It's tough to win in Colorado. Teams have found that out all year long. It's on. And I struggle sorting these teams out one from the other in terms of who's going to finish where.
Well, let's just throw a bullet point out. How about for the Rapids? What one, you got to keep getting the best out of your best players. Georgie and Hafanavahu are doing that right now.
Jonathan Lewis.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. And then it's center back depth. Like, they can't afford to lose another one. Yep. RSL, how do you build chemistry with a lot of home games down the stretch between Luna, Gonsalves, Chicho, and then figure out whoever the heck it is on the right wing? It was Lachlan Brook in this game. You're not going to replace Andres Gomez. That's not reasonable, but you need some facsimile of what he brought, which is just like pace, stretch the field, good decision-making, goal dangerous, you'd hope every once in a while. Seattle? I don't know, man. It's looking pretty good for them. I don't want to get Anders excited or anything, but like, there's something cooking there. You're talking about recent schedule, recent results.
13-5-1 across all competitions since Jordan Morris moved to the number nine. And he was great in this game against Sporting Kansas City at everything except putting the ball in the back of the net, which I know is like the main job of the number nine, but I'm not worried about him doing that. I'm just worried about him continuing to be aggressive, because when he is, it creates chances like the one that Jackson Reagan scored on that set piece. And the one that Paul Rothrock scored. Like, the Sounders are cooking. They need Pedro de la Vega. It's the same stuff we've said all year. Need Pedro de la Vega to be a match winner if they're going to beat LAFC. But I don't think they'll be scared at all of anybody else in the Western Conference playoffs.
How many pints do you think Stu Armstrong and Ryan Gold, the Scottish boys out on the town of Vancouver, pounded after Armstrong got his first goal on what was an absolutely, absolutely gorgeous run of play? Now, it was San Jose. But
so, I've been banging the same drum for a while that the Caps are a good team, but they don't have the top end quality to be a true threat in the Western Conference. And bear in mind, we're talking about a team that has only ever won a single playoff game. Does the addition of Armstrong, who's a DP, and the right back Ocampos, who's a U22 initiative, and the development of Pedro Vite, who's been really good the past 2 months, do I have to reassess my prior?
Until proven otherwise, no.
Well, the schedule turns into a wood chipper starting this week. The easy part is over. They had 3 easy games out of the League's Cup. They didn't give up a single goal. The schedule turns into a wood chipper starting this week. We'll see.
Here's what they would need to get there. And I think they could. It's plausible. One, Brian White has to come back.
Yes.
And get in some sort of match fitness, match form ahead of the playoffs. 2, Stuart Armstrong has to be the guy he was billed to be and the guy that they need, which is somebody who can advance the ball in midfield, who can make things a little bit unpredictable. 3, all those things make Ryan Gold a better player, and he's already one of the most honest, productive number 10s in the league overall. I still think Fafa has to continue to produce 9 goals on the season, and he is a freaking menace in the air, but you need that secondary or tertiary goal threat. Yeah, I mean, all those things come together, and they got a chance, and it's still no guarantee for Vancouver.
I'm going to put you on the spot. 3-8 in the Western Conference. How do these teams finish?
Can I ask you something and put you on the spot? You said it was a 3-point gap between the Rapids and Houston. LAFC are just 1 point ahead.
I said at the top, I cannot bring myself to believe that LAFC are going to fall out of the top two.
Okay, fine. You answered capably. All right. I'm going to take the Seattle Sounders in 4th. The Colorado Rapids hold on to 3rd, probably by the skin of their teeth. RSL finish 6th.
Even though they have that soft schedule coming up, they have by far the easiest schedule.
Yeah, I have concerns on both sides of the ball right now. I love RSL. I wish it wasn't going down like this, but it just feels like something is lost for them. They'll have their narrative in the playoffs. They'll be the underdog. It'll be perfect. And then I'm going to say I've got Houston and Vancouver left, right? And I've got fifth and seventh open. Vancouver finished fifth. Houston finished seventh. The Achiachi injury just it takes that little bit of wind out of their sails, and Vancouver have the game in hand. I'll be dead wrong. I did a whole thing on countdown ahead of the games talking about the Eastern Conference bubble, and I was dead freaking wrong. Every result went against
Anders,
me.
Make sure you write that down because we're going to revisit that ad nauseum the rest of the year.
Hooray. All right, let's just hit the bubble real quick since I teased it. Life around the playoff line. What was the best win for you?
Is it Minnesota?
It could be Minnesota.
Yeah, I think it's Minnesota. Given
speaking
that they
of being wrong, can I again apologize to Kelvin Yeboah? I was not familiar with your game. All right, yeah. Kelvin, I really wasn't.
He's been awesome. Minnesota had not beaten anybody except San Jose and Sporting Kansas City for 4 months. So the fact that they went to St. Louis, who have been playing well over the past month and a half since making all of those changes in the summer window. The fact that they went to St. Louis and got a pretty comprehensive 3-1 win. They played out of a 4-2-3-1 that made a lot of sense. New guy Joaquin Pereira was playing as sort of a left half space playmaker with Robin Lud floating as a number 10. Kelvin Yeboah, absolutely awesome as a lone center forward. And then building everything down that left-hand side so that Bongi Longwane was isolated on the opposing left fullback. Bongi got a goal, forced an own goal. Yeboah got converted a penalty. This was the first time in almost half a year that Minnesota have felt like a cohesive, quality playoff team. And they now have a 5-point gap between Dallas, ahead of Dallas and Austin. And I don't think those teams have enough to catch them. I think Minnesota punched their ticket to the playoffs with this win.
It sounds to me like Dallas are going to get in the playoffs as well. If that's the case, because Austin's results down the rest.
No. Dallas, because Portland's in eighth. Minnesota's in
never nine. Mind. Sorry, Dallas. Sorry to get your hopes up. You're probably done too. Austin are done. I don't see any way of them coming back after losing in Toronto. That was their easiest game of the remaining schedule, and it was away across the country. They lost it 2-1, which means the best result was Toronto because their schedule's a wood chipper the rest of the way. John Herdman had to win this game to get that little cushion that they need in the East, but they don't play on decision day. They've got Canadian Championship. They've got every match day, Saturday, Wednesday, filled all the way through to October 5th. Then they'll watch their fates from the couch. I think it's a good chance that they don't get into the playoffs. The issue is nobody else in the East is taking advantage of that's a demolition derby, and they're all just hanging on by a thread. So congrats to Toronto. You had a good result. Austin, that's a bad result. You're done. And Atlanta United, Doyle, has to be the worst result. Before I let you go in on them, I just want to read the quote, if I can find it here, from Rob Valentino, because he was not happy with his team. He used some choice words, including an F-bomb in the presser afterwards. Quote, I know there were a lot of fouls out. No, that was Pat Noonan. Uninspiring, not a good performance, said Rob Valentino. I apologize to the people that watched that. And apparently the crowd thinned out considerably for the last 20 minutes. They ain't got it.
No, they don't. They're a worse team than they were a couple of months ago, which is no surprise. They sold three of their best players and were only able to replace one of them. And I like Alexei Moranchuk. I think he's a good player in a lot of ways. He's a very different number 10 than Thiago Almada was. Different to the point where maybe he's best suited as a winger. It just doesn't click. They look like a team playing for the substitute teacher. And that's no slight on Rob Valentino. It's just tough to be the interim coach for that long.
To be fair, they played like crap for the regular teacher, too.
Yeah. Yep. So maybe it's going to be time for an overhaul. There's a lot of stuff's going to be torn down this winter, and there's going to be a new teacher. And there's going to be a lot of other new stuff too. And the hope.
New principal.
Yeah.
The hope. New star students, you would hope.
the hope is that it all comes together quickly in 2025 for Atlanta fans, because this team, technically not out of the playoffs. They're only 2 points back of DC, and crazier things have happened. But, man, they do not look like they have it at all.
So in my predictions, I had Toronto dropping, Atlanta going in. Look like a real dummy for that one right now. And then I had DC holding on. Well, DC had a bad first half against New York City, but a good second half. They get the 1-1 draw, and New York City have now not won in seven games. Meanwhile, the Red Bulls lost to Chicago. Charlotte lost in Montreal, the only team in the East, not in the top three, fighting for that four spot that looked at least like they could play the part of a number four seed, is Orlando City, who whomped the Revs, who look officially dead. What is wrong with the Red Bulls, Doyle? Let's just run through this real quick. We've got Luca Richmond saying, I think it's realistic to imagine the Red Bulls falling down to the eight or nine spots in the Eastern Conference.
I don't think that's super realistic, given how poor Charlotte and Toronto have been. Those teams would both have to pass the Red Bulls.
So it's not a compliment to the Red Bulls.
Correct.
It's that their competition is also decidedly mid.
No, the issue for the Red Bulls is that since Emil Forsberg last played, which was June 1st, they've won 2 out of 15 games across all competitions, and they've scored 16 goals in those 15 games. They are who we thought they were. They are a team that lacks top-end match-winning talent. The end. I'm sick of talking about them. We don't have to talk about them.
Agreed, the end. New York City, to me, just not getting enough out of these attackers.
Yeah, you know, things really changed when Malachi Jones got hurt. He had won the one of the starting winger spots, and he was just relentless about getting into the box. He was averaging something close to like 9 box touches per 90.
Oh my, really?
Yeah.
That's incredible. I did not quite realize
it was Bolonga extent type of
his
numbers.
Influence. Yeah. That's crazy.
And none of the other guys have really done much of that, save for Agustin Ojeda, who has only played like 130 minutes in the past couple of months. So I think Ojeda, or maybe Julian Fernandez, has got to get out there. Hannes Wolf has seen his box touches drop. Santi Rodriguez seen his box touches drop. And it's almost like Berhalter's national team, where like, oh, they're playing good soccer, but they're not sure of when they flip the switch from possession to attack. That decisiveness was part of what made Jones so good. And it was infectious with the rest of that NYCFC attack. And that decisiveness is kind of gone. So it looks a little turgid, ponderous, stale. Choose your descriptor. But I think it's something that they can fix. It's something that you could see in film. And these are all, for the most part, these are young wingers. And you could say, hey, here's what we want from you. In this moment, you go. And I think it'll get fixed. I like the talent on NYCFC more than I like on Charlotte or the Red Bulls, and probably equal to what they've got in Orlando. The big difference in Orlando is Facu Torres is a proven match winner, and Martin Ojeda is getting there as well.
What was the game when Maxi came back and he just pulled every string, and it was this big sort of, oh, they have this extra piece and here we go. Like, when did that happen?
I want to say that was a game against Orlando.
Orlando. I think, yeah, I don't know. It just feels like that was the last time I watched this team play, and I was like, oh, that's what all these guys look like when they're at their absolute best.
Yeah, and I think that was like a 4-2 win.
I think that's right.
And I think, look, part of the issue is they're a much different team when Maxi's playing the 10 than they are when Santi Rodriguez is playing the 10. So they're kind of swapping back and forth one game after another, and I think it's made it hard, especially because you're trying to figure out new wingers as well. It's made it hard for everybody to get on the same page.
As for Charlotte, I think you kind of rolled it there. They never had the attack, really, and when they did, it was through Pat Agyeman, who has a stub toe, and now it's Karol Swiderski, and all my hopes and dreams of Karol coming back and coming good and like either providing value in the transfer window for Charlotte or providing value on the field seem to be just slipping away. And now they're more vulnerable, Doyle. Like, they tried to take that step, and they just aren't the like, we're going to choke you out defensive team that they were for much of the season. So a little bit of a, little bit of a personality question mark for Charlotte right now, and certainly a production one as well when it comes to the attack. All right, let's get out of here. Before we do, just real quick, match day 33 is Wednesday, so no rest for the weary. We'll look ahead. What's the best soccer game? Give me the game and maybe a sentence or two.
Houston versus Vancouver. Just because of everything we were just talking about in terms of that 3-8 scrum in the Western Conference and Houston seeing how they manage without Ace Ace, and Vancouver seeing if they can do it against a team as good as Houston, because I still have questions about it. And the last time these two teams met, it was 4-3 Dynamo. They were able to find gaps by using the ball, and they, they've been playing good ball recently, man. So that's the one.
I like that one. Portland LA Galaxy is low key really good as well. Phil Neville,
low key, is that not high key? I think that's of the best attacks in the league.
Figuring out the key phrase slang here the kids use. Two of the best attacks, two of the best players, number 10s, wingers, fill in the blank. It should be a really explosive, fun one. And then playoff implications. I'm watching RSL Dallas. RSL at home against Dallas. Like, if you want to be the team that doesn't drop the six, that holds onto the 3 or 4, that's a game you got to win. So more chemistry with the attacking pieces, kind of figure out some continuity on the back line as well. But I'll be watching that one closely. How about you?
Orlando versus Charlotte, because I think I agree with the point you made that Orlando has looked the best out of these teams, and they've found a way to rip teams apart through central midfield, and suddenly Charlotte are really vulnerable in that exact phase of play. So many implications up and down that Eastern Conference race because of this game.
All right, Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. Eastern time, MLS Countdown on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. Myself, Sasha Kleshchen, Kaylin Kyle, join us. That'll go right into MLS 360. That'll help you keep track of every goal, every event during the night, and then we'll wrap it all up on, you guessed it, the wrap-up at 12:30 p.m. Eastern, which you can also watch on demand the next day and through that week until we do it all again on Saturday. Thank you for listening. Thanks for rocking with us. This was a fun one, a great weekend of action. I enjoyed chatting with you, Doyle. We'll see y'all later on this week. Adios.